Accession number 22677, Reel 2.
Jeffrey's Reel 2.
Well, 6 hours went to the 1st Division, the 1st Infantry Division, Hammermet, camped on the beach there, and then I got posted from that to their 3rd Brigade, 3rd Infantry Brigade, because of a vacancy there. They had three, say, brigade has three regiments, you see. They had the Duke of Wellington's, the Foresters, and the KSLI, I think it was. And then we sat there for a little while. Then the powers of me decided to invade a little island called Pantelleria, which is the first, which actually in Europe. So we were the first troops to enter Europe, in actual fact. But some of us stayed behind as a rear party, you see, in Sousse, and the rest of them went off to Pantelleria, found no Italians, only millions of lice, and came back after a couple of days. The only case was some bloke who slipped and broke his leg on climbing aboard off on the rocks, getting onto it. But it was sort of Mussolini's idea of a Gibraltar, of a Malta, but it never came to anything. They all evacuated when we got that close. So then we came back to... They all came back to Tunisia. We went off and sat there for about another 4 or 5 months until December. Then they sent us off to Italy. Went up to Bizerta, got in a tank landing craft and chugged across to Taranto. Took about 2 days. The Navy have a very good way of conserving rations on tank landing craft. The cookhouse is at the back of the ship, the stern of it, immediately below the funnel, so the diesel fumes waft over the queue waiting for their food, which does put you off, you know. Especially with a tank landing, it has no keel, it rolls up and down, sideways. So the Navy must have saved quite a bit on their rations, transporting people across the Med. Anyway, we landed in Taranto, and then we... The advance party went off with me. We went to a place called Cerignola, which is about 100 miles further up the coast, I suppose, and waited for the rest to turn up. And I had a friend of mine who was in the air formation signals at Barry. So I thought I'd go and pay him a visit while we were sitting there doing nothing, so I trundled off on the bike to see him. Duly saw him, and I started the way back, and the bike packed up, because I wasn't supposed to be there at all. There was the bike... It wouldn't go. There's about 80 miles to go to get back. So I go try to get a tow, but couldn't find a piece of rope strong enough to tow me. The cable, telephone cable, used to break. It wouldn't take the pull. So I had to get out of the back of a truck part of the way. I ended up in an Italian farmhouse that night. Oh, yeah. Anyway, next morning I got out and lifted a truck back to where I should have been. And they were about to report me missing, I think. So I hadn't come back that day.
Did the local Italians entertain you?
Oh, yes, they're very friendly. And we couldn't speak any, I couldn't speak any Italian. I'd only been there 2 or 3 days. And they couldn't speak any English. Proper little farmhouse, you know, about 3 sons and a daughter and the old farmer. They were very friendly. I smoked my cigarettes and I drank their vino and had quite a good time. In the morning, I got back to the unit and found the bike of the piston had burned through, the big hole in the pistons burned out. So being driven flat out, I suppose. Yeah, so anyway, we spent the next Christmas there, in this place. Absolutely perishing cold it was. We had Indian Army tents at that point, big things. So we dug holes in the ground there so that the wind whistled over the top. You know, perishing cold, it snowed. We thought, this is southern Italy, we'd get back to Africa.
What was the name of the place?
Cerignola. Cerignola, I guess. Anyway, a massive cathedral there, colossal cathedral, surrounded by hovels. Little, you've seen southern, that part of Italy, and little sort of round houses. With a one room really inside. We went into one, there were the old women there, that had a charcoal brazier there on the floor. They were all sitting there with their skirts draped over the top, trying to get some warmth. They were poverty-stricken. Anyway, from there we went across to outside Naples, over the mountains, over the Apennines, in the pouring rain. Got to Naples, on the other side there, and the roads were all flooded. Been raining for days. And we sat there for about a week. Then they told us we're going to go invade the Italian coast further up beyond Cassino, because Cassino had been going for months and they couldn't get anywhere. So old Church had a bright idea of landing us a bit nearer to Rome to outflank them, you see. So we drove down to Castel del Mare, I think it was called. Got aboard these tank landing crafts. And they told us we're going to land at Anzio, which we duly did. All the Italians knew where we were going. We didn't know. We were left. What would the Italians all seem to know? They told us where we were going. The Italians did. Before our people told us. So we landed at Anzio. There was no opposition. We landed alongside the quay there. First impression of Anzio was they see the Navy did a bit of liberating, as you might say, or lowering a from the top of a four-story building, they got a gantry going out. They were lowering a radiogram down to the ground. There's a lot of liberating going on, you know. Because the buildings weren't damaged at that point. There were no Germans around. So he went off. We were told to dig slit trenches and bomb shelters and things. Because we've been told we've got to land there and go straight inland and cut the German forces off, you see. We had an American general who was so scared of his shadow, he decided to sit there and wait till he got a big enough army to do it, as he thought. About three divisions landed there that day, one British, two American. We just sat and waited. The bloke with the water cart went and had a look at Rome, came back and told nothing between us and Rome. We could have driven there any time we liked, you know. There were no Germans anywhere.
Which bloke was this?
Bloke driving the water cart. He took his water car to Rome and back.
A local Italian?
No, one of our blokes. In the RASC. You could go to Rome if you wanted to. Nothing to stop you. There were no Germans about anywhere. But this daft American general, he just decided we should sit there and wait. So he waited about 10 days. And of course, the Germans came. They brought them down from France and everywhere else. I suppose, really, you see, the whole point... If you look at it, basically, the whole point of Anzio was to draw the German troops away from France so they wouldn't be able to attack our blokes when they landed later on. Just to withdraw away as many troops as possible, which it succeeded in doing. But as far as helping the ones at Cassino, it was a waste of time. Didn't help them in the least. What Hitler called the biggest prisoner of war camp in Europe. We were in because we were surrounded by Germans within 10 days. Couldn't go anywhere. So instead of being a fighting force, it was sort of like, well, it's a prisoner of war camp. You couldn't move out of it. Anyway, then we sat there and we moved off a bit and we moved as far as we ever did, up towards there's a railway station, Caracito. We went up there. And one day we were stuck in an open. I mean, I don't know who chose the site we were supposed to, the brigade headquarters was supposed to be on. It was on the top of on a hill. Well, a little bit of a hill. Out in the open, in full view of the Alban Hills, where the Germans were, and they could see us quite clearly. Everything we did, they could see. They didn't need any observation aircraft. They could see us with a pair of field glasses. So we sat there, the occasional shell coming over, you know. The Germans were practicing at that point with air bursts. You know, an anti-aircraft shell that fires over the top of you. Yeah, it was very accurate, but they were still learning how to do it. So they send these airbursts over now and again, which wasn't very comfortable. And then the Germans started to attack us, you see. And I had to take a radio operator and his set, because the radio set in those days was a colossal thing, about 2 foot long. Then you had to take wet batteries as well. So this set must have weighed about 40 pounds, and the wet batteries must have weighed about the same. So I had to take this operator and his set up to relieve to replace... His paddle had gone hit by a shell on his trench. He just disappeared. The shell had wiped out the operator and his set and everything at the battalion headquarters. So I took him up there and I got him there, and they started shelling us. So I got in the slit trench, and there was a captain in there who was steadily getting steadily drunk. He had a bottle of whiskey with him about halfway down he'd got. He just sat in the one half of the slit and me in the other. Looked at each other for about 2 hours. He didn't give me any whiskey, though. So anyway, I got fed up with that, so I decided to try and get back. I'd done English for hours. I like my food, you see. So we got back, so I managed to run back up the hill. Nobody bothered with me. You can see the Germans on the other side of the hill, you see. There was one who was a bit mad. He was jumping up and down. You know, he was gesticulating out in the open. In the end, one of these infantry blokes got fed up, so he shot him, you see, and they got told off for doing that, because they gave away the position where they were. Anyway, I got back to the Jeep. Somebody pinched the Jeep, so I had to walk back to Brigade Headquarters to get back there. I had something to eat, and I caught in my little bivouac in the ditch. And I got woken up a bit later on. And apparently, the line section had come back, because they'd lost their Jeep. That the steering column being cut up by a shell burst. And nobody believed them, you see, so they sent me out to have a look to confirm it. So I went out at my Jeep there and had a look, and their Jeep was sitting there. Honestly, you wouldn't believe it, the Jeep was undamaged, apart from the fact the steering column had been cut clean off. So the steering wheel, about 6 inches of steel of column, was sitting on the driver's seat, just like that. So I hitched my Jeep on the... So I tied my Jeep to his Jeep. There's you going backwards, you see, back to back. And I towed it back. I got back in my little hole again. And blow me, another hour or two later, I got woken up again. We were told to go and get out quick, because the Germans were coming around the back of us. We were being cut off. So somebody had taken the Jeep, so I found my motorbike as well there. So I got on that and went back. Then the Germans started shelling the road. And they dropped 3 shells, one some distance behind me, one a bit nearer, and one right behind me. And I felt a bump on my leg. It, just like a lump of stone hit me or something. It didn't hurt. So, is that a window cleaner? I found that something hit my leg a bit later on. I was opened the throttle to get out of the way, see, there weren't any more, luckily. And when it got a bit further on, I sort of slowed down. I found I couldn't make the brake work. I couldn't put any pressure on the brake pedal. So I was relying on the handbrake, the front brake. So I decided I'd better go and have a look at the field ambulance, because we knew where all the sections were, all the things were there. I knew everything was. I knew where the field ambulance was, all right. So I went down to see them. They got off the bike, you see. I found I couldn't just about walk. My left leg was just about to take the strain. I hobbled in there and got my boots off. I had a riding boot on, you see. Found the chap had gone through about 5 layers of leather and the metal buckle. Then threw me. Ended up on the bone. So, about half of that, I couldn't stand on the leg after that. You see, it hit the tendon or something. And I could stand immediately it happened, but not a bit later on. So I thought, oh, well, this is me well out of the way here. So I lay on my stretcher and waited to be carted off. And I was taken off to Naples.
Do you know the date that you were wounded?
It was about 10 days after we got there, I think. Not sure. It took us off to 101 General in Naples. And there I stayed for couple of weeks.
How were they treating you?
Well, the Italian cleaning women were the only ones we ever saw, really, as far as I can remember, apart from two of these Queen Alexander's nursing sisters came there one day, decided to pull this bit of shrapnel out of my leg. And all you could see was the point was sticking up, you see, it hadn't gone right through, just the point sticking up like a pyramid thing. They were poking around there, and I told them to get a scalpel to cut it open. Come out, they wouldn't do that. Anyway, after you're sort of shaking a bit after that, you know, so they went off. Came back the next day with the scalpel that I told them to do. A deal dim they were. Queen Alexander's nursing sisters. Anyway, they came back and they did what I told them to do, and they got it out there. It was only a small piece, about the size of a finger, you know, big enough to do a bit of damage though. Then they asked me which I'd rather have, a glass of brandy or a bottle of beer. I said, oh, I want the brandy. The anaesthetic came after they did it not before. Then he went off to Sicily then. When we like a walk a bit. No, an Italian hospital in Sicily, that's right. First of all. Then about another couple of weeks I could walk a bit on it, so I went off to convalescent camp. And then it was quite nice in Sicily. February, very pleasant there. You can see Mount Etna there, there with the Tower of Tom top. Plenty of oranges around. And that was that.
So you were supposed to be recuperating?
I was not supposed to be. I was. Yeah. So then, and then decided to fit enough to, well, these blokes in the sort of first aid section there, they dealt with all the bits and pieces looking at you. So I put a cold compress on my leg, sort of bandaged it all down there. They didn't realise I got riding boots. It was supposed to be a cold compass. Of course, I had riding boots, but it warmed it up. It took all the skin off, you see, on the other leg. So I had to go back in there, sort of casualty thing there for a fortnight while the skin came back. The skin healed up. Anyway, eventually, I was no hurry to go back to Anzio, I'll tell you. I seen all I wanted to see that. So I didn't mind waiting another fortnight. So then we went off to a camp outside Naples, Nola or something. Nola it was called. Yeah. Holding a sort of transit camp. After a few weeks there, I got sent off to, sent back to Anzio.
When you went up to the front line, when you were telling me how you went up to the front line in Anzio, did you take that wireless operator up in a sidecar?
No, a Jeep. We had Jeeps as well as motorbikes, you see. We had about, we all had about six, eight of us in the section. We had six motorbikes and two Jeeps. We used to share the Jeep between us, according to what was wanted, you see. We didn't have sidecars at all.
Which infantry unit were you going up to, do you know?
Duke of Wellington's. Duke of Wellington's regiment. Yeah. They were not a happy bunch that day. Anyway, you say, got back to Anzio, still the same places, went back to the same trench I'd been in 3 months before. We made a nice little shelter there. I got told off for chopping down a tree. Because to make the shelter, I chopped a tree down, you see, and had all the old doors from Anzio, the one being bombed over the top, made a nice little place down there. It's still the same one. And we used to share. Another division was also there. We took it in turns, you see. So one brigade would be in the front for so many days, and they'd be relieved by the other one. They used to share the places. Yeah. One night there, they got back. We had to go out one night, two of us. They had 18 different places to go to, from pitch dark, 12 o'clock at night. All the different units in the brigade, you see, surrounding, called to a meeting the next morning. We got round about daylight, about 6 o'clock in the morning, just to get light. We got round to the three battalions of the other brigade, and we couldn't get to we thought we didn't know where they were anyway, so we went in their brigade headquarters signal section there, asked them where they were, and they said they didn't know for sure. They couldn't give us directions to get them because nobody went there. They used to meet their dispatch runners halfway. They used to meet their runners halfway between, you see, because you had to walk there in trenches. Couldn't go in transport, you had to walk. So I used to meet them halfway. That was the only way they ever had any communication with them. So we said, okay, we'll leave our stuff with you and it'll go out next runner in half an hour's time. So we left it with them, went back, and then I don't know what happened exactly, but about a week later, our officer called in to find out what had happened because they'd never got the message. All the other units had turned up for the meeting apart from the three battalion commanders who were the most important of all, you see. But we had done our bit. We left it with them, got a signature for it, and that was that. No, Anzio wasn't a pleasant place at all. You say, it's always got the Albert Hills. We're on flat ground on the coast. It was the old Pontine marshes, full of frogs. It was all marshes. They used to blow holes in there to drain the water into pools, because otherwise it's a quagmire. All you could hear at night were the frogs going off. And, of course, the Mozzies, plenty of them around. But the Germans were occupying the Alban Hills, which were just inland, and so they could see everything we were doing. It was a ridiculous situation. We just sat there in full view of them. The only shelter we had were the trees. Anyway, one day, they broke out eventually. We got round the back of the casino, and our lot pushed out, and then Mark Clark decided he wanted to go and pay his respects to the Pope, instead of doing what he was told to do. He'd been ordered by Alexander, as you read now, to cut inland, you see. We were originally supposed to do, cut off the Germans, cut their entire army off and deal with them. But no, he wanted to go and see the Pope. So he let the Germans escape. He left the road open for them, and they all trooped north. And he went to see the same Papa. After we went, he moved a bit away from Anzio, a bit nearer to Rome, within about 10 miles, I suppose. And Lord Shepherd and I decided to go and have a look at Rome. They'd been captured. Well, I think Mark Clark went down June the 4th, I think. So by June the 6th, it was out of bounds to everybody, supposedly. But the other bloke at the photograph there, maybe decided to go and have a look at it just the same, because we go anywhere you like being a DR. Nobody could stop you, really. They didn't know who you were or where you were going. So he went into Rome. Oh, lovely time there. Crowds of people milling around. We drove around there, look at the Colosseum and all the rest of the places. And came back.
Did the crowds give you a welcome?
Yeah, some bloke offered me a Victory V cigarette. The things nobody ever would ever smoke. I don't know how he got hold of these Victory Vs, but he offered me one, so I politely declined. These things are made with camel dung, I think, as a theory, made in Egypt. And nobody would accept that they offered us. We had them once. Then we were offered them again later on, as part of our free issue, you see. Because we used to get 50 a week free issue. Then you could buy another 100 or something like that. But we refused to have them, nearly had a riot in their hands. I'd take them back, get something decent. But this bloke had Victory V's there. Within 2 days of the Germans going, he got hold of these things. Yeah, we got back and then we found, of course, what the excitement was all about, really. The June the 6th, and they'd landed in France, you see. So that was probably what the Italians were cheering about. No, not at all. I sat there outside Rome for about another month or so. Saw all the sights. And then started off again. Went up towards Florence. Because they'd gone back. They'd gone back from Kesselring, you see, the German. It was a very clever bloke. It was a wonderful general, really. He managed to keep the German army permanently, always ready to they retreated time and time again. And they maintained control all the way. He's a wonderful chap, really. How they managed to do it, I don't really know. Because there were more Germans there than there were allies at one point. You see, more German soldiers. We have greater air superiority. Anyway, they decided to make a line north of Florence, the Hitler line, I think it was called, up in the mountains, in the Apennines, at the top of, between Florence and Bologna. So they're stuck there. We gradually pushed them back to that point. And then I decided I had enough of the infantry. They won over strength, so they'd replaced me by somebody else while I was away. Me coming back, they were rather surprised. So I won over strength, I went and asked for a transfer. I got fed up with the infantry. So they posted me off to the medium regiment, the 76th medium regiment.
As a Donar?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you all stayed in the same grade. And so one day I went off to the 76th medium regiment. Which was really a nice, friendly little unit that was. Very friendly lot. 4.5-inch howitzers, which were well behind the line, usually. That was a good sign. Not likely to get shot at. So, there were only four DRs in that section. There was no Landskorps, nothing, just four of us. About the whole strength, the whole signal strength, only about 30. We had an officer in charge, who we never saw. And operators, linesmen, and DRs is all there was, you see. So just four of us, quite friendly. we had a radio set there, which we usually hear the news on. Tells what was happening, which I've never had that privilege before, don't know what was actually happening. And we got along very nicely. They usually had buildings to sleep in. We didn't normally sleep in tents like the infantry lot did. And anyway, I got to Florence. Yeah, the Germans had blown the bridges as usual, but the river there was so low, it was only about an inch or so of water in the Arno at that time. They'd blown the bridge across it. But they were very, very careful with ancient buildings. They didn't blow the Ponte Vecchi, you see, in Florence. They just blew the buildings either end, so you couldn't cross it. Not that the bridge would have taken the weight of a three-tonner, probably. So we spent, we moved up there, just outside Florence, and then from there we had a shock one day. December, I think it was, we moved on. We went miles and miles up into these Apennines. We got colder and colder. You know, it's like going from autumn to midwinter within a few miles. We got up into the mountains there. No buildings. Got these blooming old bivvy tents out again. And they practiced in a field leading down to a little stream. And it poured in rain and the gales blew all night long. I spent all night holding a little tent pole up trying to keep the tent from blowing away. Most of the bloke, everything was soaking wet by morning. And they couldn't get the trucks out because they were on a downslope. They had a great difficulty hauling back up on the road again. Eventually they found us a building, up a little track. And they spent Christmas up there. There's nothing to cold to sleep on, it's concrete. The wooden floor is quite warm, but concrete, or earth is warm, comes up, but concrete's the coldest thing you can think of. Concrete there, very cold. We had an old stove in this building there, and we went looking for wood to light it. And we chopped down one of the old boy's trees. It's one of these olive trees. And he went mad when he heard this. He came down storming to us, he said. He said that tree was planted when he was born, and it grew up when he did, and it would serve him all his life. We chopped it down.
Would he have got any compensation?
Oh, I shouldn't think so. No, he gave me a few fags and that was that. Compensation? No. Not for one tree. No. Anyway, we stayed there, round there. Because of the weather, you see, they couldn't get stuff to us. We couldn't get supplies to us. The first priority was ammunition and petrol, mail. The food came last, you see, so we spent the winter there living on dehydrated meat, dehydrated potatoes, rice and biscuits. And all the Italians had to eat was chestnuts. They used to roast them and fry them and boil them and everything else. But eventually, I started getting jaundice, you see, because of the food, I suppose. And I got jaundice. Nothing, I'm off a few days away. So we go down the MO with a little bottle showing what... jaundice, the urine goes as a funny colour, it has a deposit, as your eyes go yellow as well. So I said, okay, off you go. So I got a lift, sent for the Indians provided the ambulances there because it was an Indian div. They parked me in the front seat of this ambulance with the Indian driver, who has a hairy driver all my life over the mountain roads. Back to Florence, there was a holding area. Then they flew us down to Naples again. No, flew us to Sicily again, straight there. By that time, of course, my jaundice had gone. I only had to eat a couple of decent meals, and I was okay. I spent about a fortnight in this Sicilian hospital again, then start the trek again. It took me 2 months to get back. It took me 24 hours to get there and 2 months to get back.
Why did it take you so long?
Well, you see, these transit camps, I think the theory was the bloke in charge had ration allowance for all the people in the place. So it was up to him to have as many there as possible. The more rations there, the more he could siphon off to flog on the black market. The black market was a thriving industry in Italy, you know. Yeah. You see, I mean, you could sell your cigarette ration for more than you pay. That's when I started smoking a pipe. Italians don't smoke pipes. But cigarettes were currency, you see. You can get more for your cigarette ration than you can pay quite easily.
What would you want to exchange the cigarettes for?
Money. Oh, you got some, I don't know what it was. I forget how much I know. You got a lot of money for them, far more than you. You're restricted the amount you could buy, you see, in the Naffy, but you had your 50 free, and about 100 you could buy. Or you could sell bars. A bar of soap was valuable. A tin of bully beef would get you anything. But a bar, all the Italians have for soap, it was very rough stuff. I tried it once. Sort of caustic, very caustic, sort of rocky stuff. Rough, you know. A bar of soap, they thought it did look. A bar of Life Boy or something, or palm olive. Anyway, the Italian women used to do washing for us. You give them a bar of soap, they do the washing for you for free, you know, just for the bar of soap. Yeah. Anyway, I got to Florence, up in the mountains. I got jaundice, that's right. Took about 2 months to get back, because you go from one transit camp to another, you see, all the way up the line. Eventually arrived there, back there in the mud and the rain again. A bit warmer by then, about February by then, I think. February, beginning of March, probably. So back to the same place again. And usual routine. We didn't have much to do as DRs there. We only had two batteries, you see. We didn't really go anywhere else. There was nothing really to do, the medium regiment. Not compared to